welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
So today we have a very special guest joining us, and we are so excited to get into our interview with her. So we're going to be heading straight into that after just a few notes here.
Yes. Firstly, as always, we have spoilers in this episode. Like, big spoilers.
Lots of them.
So if you don't want to have anything spoiled, maybe read the book first.
Yes, I loved this book. Spoiler alert, Zoe loved this book. And I highly recommend you all go out and buy and read The Ray Kess if you
Absolutely.
Haven't already.
Oh, so good.
Yes. And so, like, I mean, for me, this book sang to my heart. I loved everything that it does. And I think that that will be evident as you hear our interview fangirling a little bit here. But I really love it. And I just, we both want you to know, like, we think you really should read this book first, because we don't get into the synopsis per se, but we do talk about details that happen within the book. So we're going to spoil some things. Also, you might not understand what we're talking about when we ask specific questions, things like that. So I think that about covers it. What do you think, Kelsey?
I think so. I think we should jump right into this interview that we had with the lovely Scarlett Peckham.
So today we are joined by the fabulous author of The Ray Kess, Scarlett Peckham.
Welcome.
Yay.
Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to talk to you. I am a really big fan. So this is really, really exciting for us. So how have you been holding up in these odd times?
It is odd times. I'm holding up, but I mean, I almost never leave my house anyway. So in the beginning, it was a little bit like, okay, business as usual. It's just really depressing if you turn on the news. Mm-hmm. But then when you took away like going to Pilates and going to Target, I began to slowly lose my mind. Yeah. So even the likes of me is like, what is going on?
Yeah, I'm also enjoying like working from home. It's really cool, but it's starting to wear on you. But luckily, you know, we have all got some good books to read. So
yes.
Hey, look at that segue. But yeah, so we like to break the ice, you know, with the toughest question we're going to ask you of all the questions today, I think.
It's
usually what it ends up being.
Definitely. But so we want to know, do you have a favorite romance novel?
I have a favorite romance novel, and I will like go to war over this book because I think it is brilliant. My fave is Flowers from the Storm by Laura Kinsale.
Yes.
Have you guys read that?
I haven't read it.
No, I haven't.
I like just ran across it again yesterday, like in some search of something.
It's not only my favorite romance novel, it's one of my all-time favorite books. And it's about, it's about a duke named Shervo, which is a great name for a duke. And he is like a liberal politician and kind of a rake hell. And then he has a stroke and loses his powers of speech and winds up in a mental institution. And lo and behold, this woman that he'd sort of known due to his sideline and being a brilliant mathematician, as all, you know, rakish dukes are, he finds himself in the care of this Quaker woman named Maddie, who is like the only one that can understand that he hasn't lost his mind. He's just lost his powers of speech. And so it's one of the most beautifully written books I've ever read. But like part of the power of it is the fact that like Shervo can't speak almost until 2/3 of the way through the book, he's still stringing together sentences like about a 4-year-old.
Wow.
It's so powerful and it's so beautiful. And the love story is like so angsty because she's a Quaker and can only marry within her faith. But then she has to like help him. So that requires her to like be with him. And then like, do they need to get married? I don't want to give anything away, but like,
there's a lot of moving parts.
I literally like laid on my couch. It's a really long book. It's like kind of more old school style where there's a massive sprawling plot and like so many different strands, but they're all fascinating. And like, if you just want to lay on your couch and cry for 15 hours, it is the book for you.
I mean, honestly, right now, like a good cry is kind of like important. So that sounds like, okay, yeah. Kelsey and I both, our histories with romance started. So I got into romance because of Kelsey. Kelsey introduced me to romance not that many years ago. Six, maybe?
I think we're coming up on six, yeah.
Something about that. Wow. So like, we both have not read a ton of more older school romances. And so now that we're like talking about them on a podcast, we keep talking about how we really need to like read some of the foundational stuff. I mean, maybe some even Hare, Georgette Hare, I think is how you pronounce it. But like, we need to like, yeah. So I was actually just asking on Instagram, like, we need one more book for May. Any suggestions? So like, maybe that's the book.
It's so good. It's so good. I can't even tell you.
Oh, oh my gosh. You've got me hooked. So yes. I don't know. We'll have to see how it goes. Well, so speaking of our history with romance, I guess that's where we want to start with you. So can you tell us a little bit about you and your history with romance?
I can. I started reading romance because I would see my grandmother reading romance novels. And I was pretty young. I think I started when I was like 8 years old. And the reason why I wanted to read them is because she would always have like those little mass market paperbacks, but she had them in this like cloth cover, like kind of a homemade cloth book cover made out of like Laura Ashley fabric to hide, you know, the like crazy clinch covers. And so I was like, well, why is she hiding her book covers? And then obviously being like, you know, a curious young mind, I eventually took the cover off one of her books and figured out what it was. And then I figured out where her shelf, where all of her like, you know, steamy historical romance novels were hiding. And then I started, I don't know, maybe like disappearing into the back bedroom with one. And then the rest is history. Like I was hooked. Yeah. So I've been reading them forever. And I read them like, I would say that like my major period as just like a completely like absorbed reader was between the ages of like 8 and 16. And then I stopped reading them as much. And then I returned to them when I was like in my 20s working a corporate job and just like wanted something that was lighter that would take me out of my work stress. And I was like, holy moly, these romance novels have just really come a long way. They're so amazing. But like in a different way than they were just amazing when I was reading them when I was 8. Like they were really feminist and really like, I don't know, playful and sharp and observant. And I think that was probably true of them when I started reading them when I was 8, but I was more able to get what they were saying. Yeah. So yeah, that's my history.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I mean, I think like I wish I'd found romance novels when I was young because that's what my heart wanted. I just didn't know it was a thing. I read a lot of fantasy. It got like kind of close. And then in high school, I ended up reading a lot of Harry Potter fan fiction that like had way more romantic stuff. I think like that's what led me to romance or it was my introduction to romance. And like, I mean, let's be honest, Kelsey led me to romance.
I'm good for something.
Thank goodness. Now you're good for lots of things. No, I'm just teasing. It's another world.
Kelsey, how did you get into romance?
I got into romance. A really good friend of mine from high school, when I was a freshman year of college, I was in New York from California. So I was a long way from home. And my friend would send me, like, we always read a lot of the same books. And she had started getting into romance novels. She picked them up from her mother because she'd like, her mom was reading some, I can't remember what author, but she was laughing hysterically throughout the whole book because it was just like a very Farsi kind of romance novel. She's like, what are you reading? And so she read it and then handed it off and was like, I need to give this to Kelsey. So she would send me literal care packages of books.
Aww.
Like that her mom had like given to her and then she'd give to me. So it just got me on this journey. And then, yeah, so then we just got started. We picked up the Bridgerton series and like that's what we did over winter break. And like she would get them from the library and then like pass them off to me. And she'd be like, they're due on this date, like send them back before this date. So then I'd hurry, like furiously read the Bridgerton book and send them back. And it just kind of spiraled from there until it was pretty much all I was reading. Aww. Because what better way to escape in the middle of finals week than just pick up a romance novel for a few hours?
Definitely.
Oh my goodness, yes. You know, I'm kind of jealous. I never had like a romance friend. It wasn't until I started writing romance that I like found a ton of other people who also like read a lot of it and could just like finally share all the feelings I'd been building up for 3 decades. Because it's so fun to just like squee and compare notes over your favorite books. It's kind of lonely when you're like the only one you know who's reading them.
I completely agree. So then, Scarlett, how did you make the jump from a romance reader to a romance writer?
I had been noodling around with this idea for a romance novel for like 5 years on vacations from work, or like when I occasionally had like one of those panics where you're like, oh my God, I need to be doing more with my life. And I would wake up at 6 a.m. and like scribble in a notebook.
And so, I know nothing about that. That's nothing.
Yeah. I know a lot about it too. And yeah, so that's sort of how my first kernel of an idea was born. I had this idea for like a botanist named Poppy and a emotionally tortured Duke with a tragic past, but I didn't really have like it was more just like I would like scribble scenes for fun in a notebook. It wasn't really a book or anything. And then I worked in PR for like 10 years and I had been transferred by my former company to their London office from their New York office. And it was crazy and very intense and somewhat draining. And I felt really burnt out at the end of my 2-year relocation contract. So I was like, I think I'm going to take a year off and like figure out what to do next. And I think I'm going to stay in London for that because I've only like worked 14-hour days and haven't really experienced like life here. And so I was supposed to just sort of take a gap year and like, I don't know, determine if I wanted to go to grad school or whatever, but I was going to write my little romance novel that I've been tooling around with in this notebook for years during that process. And then I was like, oh my God, I think maybe the career change is like, I just want to write romance novels. So it went from like a lark I was doing on vacation while trying to find myself to being like the thing that I actually found.
Nice.
And here we are.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, we're very thankful for that.
Oh, me too.
Very. So you're writing now full time? You get to write full time or?
Yes, I do get to write full time. I think I was sort of lucky in that I had already planned to take some time off. So I had like savings and I had a partner with income. So like my not working during that time was okay. And then I self-published my books, which fortunately they did well enough that, you know, it's like a job, which is kind of fun, but also kind of depressing because it used to be my little like fun hobby. And now it's like, oh God, I really need to start delivering on that house party book. like, back to the salt mines.
Well, so that was one of my questions, because like your first 3 novels are self-published. Mm-hmm. And then the Raycast is now with Avon, right?
Yeah.
So this is your first book with a publishing house. So I was curious, like, what brought you to self-publish? And then how did the Raycast come to Avon?
Well, how did I start self-publishing is a very, very simple answer. It is that my book didn't sell. I had no intention of self-publishing what went on to become my first book. I did the usual thing where you enter it in contests and submit it to agents and query, 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 query. And I found my lovely agent, Sarah Younger, who is like one of my favorite people on earth. And she loved the book and I loved the book. The book in question is The Duke I Tempted, which is the first book that I published. I think it was called something like Confess Your Grace at the time, like much less snappy title. And she did the usual thing where, you know, you edit it and then you send it out to every publisher imaginable. And they were all like, the writing's good, but I'm not really sure about this. And I was like, guys, like, come on, Submissive Duke, this is fun. So it
is fun.
I stand by it. It is fun. I mean, there's also a lot of things in that book that are not fun, to be clear. But so we decided that, like, I wanted it to be my debut book, and I really, like, loved that book, and I wanted it to be that series that I published first, like, rather than, you know, like, taking it, putting it in a drawer, doing something that was more traditionally, like, commercially viable according to the publishing industry. And so I self-published it, and I used my agency's help to do that, which was nice because I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. And it ended up getting some attention and selling pretty well. And, like, I loved it. I love it. I love having total control over how the books look. I love setting my own editorial schedule, hiring my own editors, hiring my own copy editors. Like, I am a type A person, and, like, it is delicious to have a project, especially after years in the corporate world of everything being collaboration and other people's agendas and timelines. Like, self-publishing was just, like, the shit. Like, I loved it. Which may then make you wonder why I have a traditionally published book coming out from Avon. And the answer to that is bookstores. I wanted to try to, like, you know, just expand my brand, because most of my books, because of being indie, sell online. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, definitely a strong market still for historical romance in the brick and mortar bookstores. However, those are all closed right now, so I'm not sure the strategy was, like, particularly suited for the era that I now find myself in. But it made sense at the time.
Yeah, you didn't know a few months ago this was the atmosphere you'd be releasing a book in.
No. My husband very helpfully described it as the worst time to sell something since World War II.
Oh, gosh.
That's not helpful, honey, but thank you.
But I will say, like, I mean, luckily, most, you know, established indie bookstores that I know are still doing pretty well with online orders. And, you know, I'm planning on making an order from my local one here soon, because I was like, oh, I know what I want to get my nephews. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to get my sister this book, you know, like, because what else are you going to do but send people books right now?
I know.
You know. So, and support local businesses. But I mean, I think also that, you know, this book, my guess is a lot of people are going to want to have the physical copy of the Raycast in their hands because the cover is so awesome.
Yay.
So I was curious, like, did you have any input on the cover, or is that all Avon, or how does that work?
I'm sure that Avon wished that I had a lot less input into the cover because I think I drove them absolutely bonkers. Bonkers. I think they were basically like, can you block her emails actually? No, my idea was that since I knew the book was coming out in mass market, which if you're not an industry head is just, you know, like the small paperback, like the kind of checkout aisle, you know, it's small, 5 by 7 inches or whatever. I wanted it to obviously look like the historical romance novels that people are used to finding at Barnes and Noble and, you know, Target. But I also wanted it to have a little bit of a nod to, like, the books that I fell in love with as a child, like those old school ones with, like, Fabio on the cover and a Technicolor rainbow and maybe a unicorn and maybe someone is maybe having sex with someone's arm or something. You can't really tell because of the way they're positioned. Like, I love those. I think they're so beautiful and, like, nostalgic and retro and fun. And I also think that, I don't know, there's something, like, magical about them. Like, the fact that my grandmother felt she needed to cover the cover with cloth when she read them, to me, there's something powerful in that. It's like they're telegraphing something to us about what's inside them. And I think that enhances my pleasure as a reader, just to, like, have this completely, like, balls out wacky art on the front. So I really wanted that. Avon was like, you can have that. That sounds cool. But it also needs to, like, it can't be too wacky, Miss Scarlet. And I was like, can it be a little wackier? And then we had, like, a 3-month negotiation on how wacky it could be. But they were amazing with doing, like, the photo shoot. Like, I got to choose the models, and I literally had, it was a blast. Like, we were on a soundstage in Chelsea. The guy on the cover, his name in real life is Keithan, I believe, was, like, maybe the hottest man I've ever seen. That was exciting. And they were like, give him some direction when we got into the studio. And I was like, so you're a damsel in distress. And she, and then I point at Loriana, who's the female model. She's like kind of, you know, the big like alpha hero who's brought you to your knees. You know, it was so fun.
Well, you know what? We totally got that vibe from the cover because she's like, oh. And he's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I got this.
Yeah.
It's so good. I mean, yeah, that, and as someone tagged her, it might have been you or somebody else tagged her on Instagram. And so now I'm like following the model and I'm just like, this is so cool.
It's great.
I don't know. What a small world. But yeah, no, that's so awesome. I mean, the cover just like gives the right vibe, I think, to the book. Like it kind of, you know, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but like, I mean, we all see that first and we all do. And, but I feel like it really does set you up like for turning that first page and like reading your author's note that's there. So like, I don't know. I'm glad you fought.
I'm glad you like it.
I'm glad you fought. Oh gosh. It's so fun.
So for you, how did the Raycast come to be? Like, what was the inspiration? Cause like, we have a lot of thoughts on the matter, but we want to hear how you came up with this inspiration for this alpha hero, or this alpha heroine, I should say.
Yeah, so the inspiration was, I always start with a trope. Like in any book, the thing that inspires me in romance is to just think of a trope that I know really well or that I really like or that I really dislike, whatever. And just sort of think about the human experience of living inside that trope. Like I find that very inspiring, like to take like marriage of convenience and then imagine what would that feel like if you literally had to be married to someone you hated or distrusted or whatever, and just kind of go to like the darkest, most emotional, like id place of that trope. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about the rake trope and how so many of the rakes that I grew up with in, you know, the books I was reading in like the 90s, many of which were actually written in the 80s or the 70s, you know, there are these guys who are wandering around like half drunk all the time. Often you would open the book and it would literally be like him having sex with his mistress, and it would be described in like quite like it was like you were in any sex scene in the book, but it like wasn't with the heroine, and that was fine. And then like as the book went on, you know, you would discover that he has all of this emotional baggage and often a lot of trauma in his past, and you would sort of begin to see that he's been numbing himself with sex and alcohol all this time. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. I wonder what it feels like to be like an actual rake instead of like a more comic version of like the reformed rake that you might see in like a lighter book, because I need to make everything as dark as humanly possible. And then I wanted to change the gender because, you know, you see so many rakes that are men, you see almost no rakes that are women. And I was thinking about like why that is. And it's pretty obvious. Like you look at the double standards in society, you look at like biology of the female body, and like, you can't have constant sex and not worry about getting pregnant before the age of birth control. And you look at, you know, just like all of these things. It totally makes sense why people aren't writing female rakes, but also what happens if you did. And then I started thinking about, I guess I think of it as being like sort of what we have instead of female rakes, which is ruined women. So like women with a past, maybe they've had lovers, maybe they haven't, but they've been accused of it, you know, like, they tend to be these kind of sadder characters who, instead of having like the happy-go-lucky, hard-drinking, like nine mistresses to his name lifestyle of the rakes that we know and love, the ruined woman has like a cottage and like one pig, and like she writes letters. Like her lot in life is so grim, and it just made me mad. I was like, well, how come he gets to be a rake and she's got to be a ruined woman? Like what happens if she is just like, no, I reject the idea that I'm ruined, which then led me to like, okay, so what if I had a female rake who is calling herself a rake because she is mad at being cast as a ruined woman for an affair that she had in which both parties, you know, were consensually, entwined with each other, but one person got out of it ruined and the other person just went on and continued his rakish ways. And then what if that was like the animating moment in her life that caused her to start thinking differently about double standards in society and what men can have and what women can have and how they can act, which led me to her being a women's rights reformer. And that's kind of how the book sort of took focus.
Well, we loved that.
Aw, thank you.
Because, and it was so interesting because something that, you know, Zoe and I actually spoke about when we were talking about the book in general just was how reading her, I did see all those rakes of the past, the half drunk sleeping with all the women to numb the pain. And it was so funny because even reading it as the reader, I wasn't as accepting of her the same way I was. And like, I would pick up a book with the man being in that role and I would immediately have forgiven him by like page 10 versus there was moments with me where I struggled because I was like, I know what I could see what you were doing as far as like, I get it. Like, I see what she's doing. I see she's numbing herself. She's just like, she's very strong in her convictions. She's not unhappy with her life, but like, she's dealing with it. And at points I was like, come on, girl, pick yourself up. Like, what are you doing?
Well, and it's, I felt the same way. I can't remember where it was, but at some point I found myself getting frustrated with Serafina. And then I had that moment where I was like, no, if this was the man, like I would still be maybe a little frustrated with him, but I would be willing to forgive him, right? And I was willing to forgive Sarah, like for sure. Like I love her. So that's, you know, that's neither here nor there. But I did have one moment in the book where I started to have that kind of like thought. And then I was like, no, like this is, I mean, that's what I feel like you were doing, which is you kind of challenging us as readers to say, like, think about how you'd think about this if it was the other way around. And so I don't know. I thought that was fabulous because it did make me stop and think as a reader, like how if this was reversed, what would I be thinking? And I think romance does a lot for us. And I think it's really cool that it did that for me in this book. So I feel like that kind of leads into another thing, which is, what would you say to someone who just says, well, I think that Serafina is an unlikable heroine?
I'd say that you're exactly right. I think that's what everyone around Serafina thinks about her. I think there's a moment in the book where her friend is actually like,
"There is.
You're one of the least likable people deliberately." Yeah, I'm really interested. Like, I literally, well, you can't see because it's a podcast, but I have stickers that I put inside my books when I send them out that say unlikable heroine. Because I like really identify with this concept of like a heroine who isn't trying to be likable. And what's the difference between a sympathetic heroine and a likable heroine and an unlikable heroine? You know, like I wanted Serafina to be sympathetic in the sense that you understand where she's coming from, that you feel compassion for her, even if you feel frustration for her choices, that you see sort of the reasons why she can be so prickly or so angry or so just drunken in her feelings. But I didn't want to take away the fact that she is prickly and angry and sometimes drunk and in her feelings, because I feel like that's just like a representation of how humanity is. And I want my heroines to read as human beings who have all of the frailties as well as all of the strengths that, you know, the women in my own life have. So I think that Serafina can be tremendously unlikable. I think she's probably going to be a very polarizing figure, like the more that people read this book, and I'm totally okay with that. But I also think that she's angry for a reason, and like her anger is sort of the reason I wrote the book. Like, I was angry. I wrote the book, I think I started having the idea in like 2016, right? As Trump was elected and Me Too was shaping up, and it was just like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm really, 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 really angry. And I can only imagine being someone in the 18th century who has even less legal rights and the ability to, you know, be respected and have a career and not take complete shit and trollery for speaking out and kind of living her own life. If I were Serafina Arden, I would be pissed off too. So yeah, she's not very likable. Deal with it.
Well, I found myself liking her, but hey, you know, I'm just teasing. So when you said Me Too, I thought that was so interesting because I really saw those parallels in the book. You know, there are writings that Sarah writes and they completely apply today, you know, about the man not getting the blame and also seeing like her former lover afterwards, you know, with other people coming forward and saying that they had been affected too. And I thought that that was so poignant for, you know, a book written right now, but also for something in the past. Like it just said something about this has kind of been going on forever and it shouldn't be okay. And we just have to like talk about it. I don't know. I mean, not to say we just have to talk about it, but that's kind of what – that's kind of one of the only things we've ever had almost available to us, you know, throughout time is just to raise our voices. And I just thought that was a – I don't know. It was something I noticed. Kelsey and I were talking about it before this, how there were just like a lot of parallels in there that we liked.
Yes. And one thing like on our show, we always look at all of our romances that we read through like a feminist lens. And we always talk about them in the sense of like, is it like not a supporter? Is it a supporter? Or is it just like a neutral book? And one thing about this is what I really enjoyed about it was that even though she was being demonized by like a village, you know, and she's seen as this horrible person. Like, I love it because you framed it and that the female relationships, even the ones that may have demonized her in the past, like end up in a supporting role of her. And that's something that I love to see because it's so because what frustrates me so often is the females victimizing other females and the females like tearing other females down. And like, for me, that's always the sticking point of looking at just feminist history is just the amount of women who are the antithesis of their feminist counterparts and the need to protect themselves. Like, cause it all comes from protection. It's like, I have so little rights and you're challenging the status quo and I need to protect what little I have. So I'm going to tear you down because I can't have you challenge that. Versus when Sarah goes through it and is challenging everyone, she ends up getting that support from females, which I loved because that's what I want to see. Women supporting women, damn it.
Yeah, that was so fun to write. And that's sort of part of the idea behind the series. It's called The Society of Sirens. And it's about this group of women friends who all support each other and kind of come up with this pact to try to change society for the better of all womankind from various different lots in life. And so you'll get to see, like, Sarah's book is obviously set in Cornwall, and she's writing this memoir, and she's more of like an intellectual figure. But the heroine of the second book, Cornelia, is a painter who straddles the world of like the black poor and the aristocracy, because she has a parent who came from either world. And then the third book, the heroine is a famous courtesan who was kind of she grew up in like a sort of Seven Dials brothel, but then has now become a much more lofty figure in society. And so just seeing how all those stories intersect and how like women can be friends and support each other in different ways, it's part of the project, I would say, of the series.
So Cornelia, I actually wanted to talk a little bit about her because I think it's about halfway through the book when you first physically describe her. And when I read that and I got to that point, I felt like it was intentional that you hadn't yet given a physical description of her, because to me, that was another moment when I put the book down and said like, oh my gosh, she got me. She got me on my bias, because I, of course, was imagining her as like white in my head because I'm a privileged white woman. Gosh. So I don't know. Was that intentional, or was that just not?
You mean not making it clear that Cornelia is a woman of color until the middle? I don't know that it was intentional. I mean, we kind of meet her in the middle of the book. So it's not that I was deliberately withholding her race. It was more that I feel like her personality comes out more through dialogue. Yeah. I don't know. It just didn't seem like I needed to make a big point about it until someone was looking at her. And then, of course, Adam, the hero, is a little bit confused by her because he is exactly as you say, like, you know, he knows that she's the niece of a noble woman, but he's not really sure why a half black woman is the niece of a noble woman. And he's just a little bit confused about it. So there's like a little bit of a semi uncomfortable conversation he has with Serafina where he's like, what? And then she explains it. And I don't know, I just wanted to be a little bit honest about like, I don't know, how these people are fitting together in society and how they know each other and the biases that the other characters might have going into that, the way that anyone, you know, might when you meet people and aren't sure how they know each other or how they intersect in each other's lives.
That's really cool. And I'm very excited for Cornelia and her book.
Me too.
So, you know, you talked a little bit about history and the time period. And I know that Serafina, you write, is inspired by Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, was she, like, was the idea for the Rakes, which came first, the Rakes or Mary Wollstonecraft? And did they, or did they converge at a time?
Mary Wollstonecraft has been floating around in the back of my head since I was 18 because I read A Vindication on the Rights of Women my freshman year of college for just like a lit hom class. And I am embarrassed to even say this, but at the time my reaction to it was like, I don't understand how this is like the seminal feminist work. It seems really misogynist to me. Because if you've read it, like there's a very, very, very strong critique of how women are behaving in society. And she talks about how they're petty and they only concern, or they're only concerned about their looks and about, you know, their status in society. And her argument in the book, at least like my reading of it, was essentially like, hey, yo, men, like, you need to educate your women so that they suck less. Like, that as 18-year-old Scarlett is sort of what I took away from it. And I was like, Mary, girl, that is not nice. and then as I was sort of thinking about the world in which I wanted to situate this book, I was reading more about the late 18th century and sort of that period in time between the US Revolution and the beginning of the 19th century. Like, how do we get from like the Enlightenment to the Regency? Because they seem so very different, you know? and I was reading about just the, you know, the kind of 1790s feminists that included Mary Wollstonecraft, and all of these different, not all of them were feminists. Some of them were just anti-monarchists, or some of them were abolitionists. But this kind of crowd of people that were running around calling for a reform at the end of the Enlightenment, a period of time that intersected with like the French Revolution and slightly proceeded from the American Revolution and occurred about simultaneously with the Haitian Revolution, and how scary that was for the conservative members of British society who were like, oh my God, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. All of these radicals are destroying the fabric of society. They are ruining our wealth and corrupting our women. And like, we have to stop them, which feels so much like our modern times.
I was just
times.
Thinking that. And I was like, I feel like that's the argument like, that's going on in this country right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that really spoke to me. I was just like, we're living in the 1790s. We're just calling it like 2018. So I was thinking a lot about that. And then because I was so interested in this period, and I think I wanted to set the book there, I remembered my old friend Mary, who I'd been so hard on when I was an idiot 18-year-old girl. And I reread A Vindication on the Rights of Women. And I was like, oh, what she's doing is being smart. She's saying like, she's directing the book to the people who actually hold the power and giving them a reason to grant education and rights to women, because she's saying, oh, look, it's not really for the women, it's for you guys. So you'll have these great wives and mothers. Like, don't worry about, like, it's not for them. It's just to like make them better for you. And I think that is like so transgressively brilliant. And then I was reading Charlotte Gordon's book, Romantic Outlaws, which is a dual biography of Mary Shelley and Mary Wollstonecraft, because Mary Shelley is Mary Wollstonecraft's daughter. And I learned more about her biography and how she actually lived and the sort of circumstances that led to her, you know, writing this book that has given me so many feelings over the years. And that also has, of course, been like a huge seminal work in feminist thought. And her life was just bonkers. Like, she had so many like really passionate well, not so many, but she had several really passionate love affairs, but she also had really terrible breakups. Like, she attempted suicide, I think twice, after a relationship ended. And she didn't believe in marriage, but then she ultimately married, because she didn't want her second child to face the stigma of illegitimacy. And she was fiercely independent and moved to France to cover the French Revolution as a journalist. And she also followed her lover's missing silver shipment to Scandinavia with her baby, like literally went on like basically like a wild goose chase for treasure. I don't know. Wow. I can't. She was an intellectual and she founded a school and she wrote all of these like very, very serious political treatises, but her life is just so rich and full of like wild heroism and also wild moments of vulnerability. And I just thought she's like such an incredible story. And then she died in childbirth, giving birth to Mary Shelley. And then her husband wrote a memoir in which he was very forthcoming about the details of her life, which most people hadn't known when she was alive. And she was absolutely vilified because people understood that she had had a child out of wedlock and that she had made all of these, you know, somewhat radical life choices over the course of her life. And then her work was sort of cast aside and she was called like a Jacobin. And, you know, I mean, she just became like this villain figure for so many years. And I was like, this totally, totally reads as exactly something that could happen in 2018, where, you know, you have a woman who's living on like her own terms and doing exactly what she wants and speaking truth to power. And then, you know, that makes people extremely upset and they use any frailty they can find to try to make her seem less legitimate. So that was why I chose Mary for Serafina.
Very, very cool. I mean, I felt the inspiration in there. I definitely enjoyed it. So before we get too far away from the characters, because I have more I want to talk about Sarah, but I also wanted to talk about how Autumn is, and kind of like you mentioned with the cover, he's a totally a flipped trope too. It's not just that Sarah is the Ray Cass, but he is kind of the one who's there to heal her, right? Like he wants to be the one to heal her. And I thought that that was really, you know, an interesting choice. You went the whole way with it, right? You didn't just, you know, take part of it. And so I found him to be also a really interesting character in that. So where did Autumn come from for you?
Autumn came exactly kind of where you're going. Like, I wanted him to be the one who is the soft one and the one who teaches her the power of love, because that's what happens in a Rake book, right? Like, he's redeemed because he finds love, and then he realizes that this part of his soul that hasn't been nourished is suddenly more vibrant, and he can be both the kind of freewheeling person he was before, and he can still be sexy and he can still be absolutely ridiculously talented in bed, but now he has more vulnerability and he's in touch with his emotions and he's, you know, he has a family and he's grown. And it's so, it's a lovely fantasy and a lovely, like, empowering character arc. And I wanted that for Serafina. So I needed to give her a man who would put up with all of her shit. And I don't mean to make Serafina out as a character that I don't like. I love her. She's like my favorite character I've ever written. But she is tough. She's got a lot of trauma and she has so many walls up. And she asks a lot of Autumn, not by actually asking, but, you know, by sort of just being who she is. She's defensive and prickly and she's really not looking for love. And he just comes on and he's like, you know what? I kind of love you.
Yeah.
And then just, I don't know. I also have never really written like a cinnamon roll hero before. And just from like a romance tropey sort of perspective, I thought it would be fun to write a little bit of a softer, more emotionally available from the jump guy. Like, Autumn is guarded in his own ways, but his guardedness comes from the stakes of his life as opposed to emotional guardedness. You know, like, he's sort of there for it the whole time, and I like that about him.
I really liked that he, you know, was good in bed and he was, you know, sure of himself there because she was so sure, right, that he wasn't going to have any idea what he was doing. So I liked that. I felt like his character had a lot of dimension, like you were talking about. It was like from his circumstances that, you know, he made these decisions. But yeah, there was one quote that I pulled out here because it was, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the last part of it is he'd entertained the idea that if he could wear that crack into a deeper fissure, he could perhaps lodge himself inside her heart and heal it. And that was when I was like, oh my God, like it was so great because that's how the heroine is always feeling, right? Like mm-hmm. she's always like, mm-hmm. I can fix him. And I loved that with him. But then at the same time, he's not an idiot, right? Which is what we don't mm-hmm. want in either our heroes or heroines, where he says pretty much right after that, but he'd seen his mother hope for the same thing and it didn't work with an alcoholic. And so like I was enjoying that.
Yeah. And there's one thing I really liked about him was that he was a very like self-confident person. Like he knew who he was as a person, which made him a very strong hero, even though his role was more of like a beta role in the sense that he wants to heal her. And like he has to kind of figure out how he fits into this, like into Sarah's life, because Sarah's this like huge alpha force, but he's not really like a step back kind of hero. Like he is very much like has his own alpha characteristics, but because he's in touch emotionally, he knows how to soften that, which I love because it balances mm-hmm. Sarah. But it's the same thing with Sarah. I think both the characters have a really great duality. You see that when Sarah like meets his children for the first time and just her interactions mm-hmm. with them and how she's such a maternal figure with them and is loving and caring. And he's like, he sees that and he's like, okay, but so that's in there. Like, she's not just yeah. this dragon lady. Like, she can be soft. She can be soft and maternal. Like, so he can immediately see that she's just put up walls to push adults away, but kids are fine. And so I love it because she has this duality, but so does he. And I just love how they ended up balancing each other out.
Yeah.
Aw, thank you.
So, but with Adam, I felt like the one thing that I was curious about was how for you did he like reconcile his own, you know, bastardy, if that's how you pronounce that, or being a bastard with then not ever getting married to Serafina?
I think that part of Adam's journey is that he has to decide if he's complicit with patriarchy or if he's willing to live outside of it. And he has to decide if all of these things that go with that, if social acceptance according to the mores of society, like if he's willing to take the risk of breaking them and accept the consequences. And so I think he's like the last man in the world who would want to have a child out of wedlock prior to meeting Serafina. And then he realizes that in order to be a partner that she would want, he has to accept her value system. And I think they're both pretty clear with each other that like, it's okay if you don't accept mm-hmm. this. mm-hmm. We don't have to be together. But if we're going to be together, I have certain, you know, hard lines that are just never, ever going to be something I can negotiate on. And so I think part of their finding a happy ending is figuring out which of their lines are hard and which ones are porous enough that they can be happy and live a life together sort of on their own terms. And I think in terms of Adam, you know, like he is someone who conformed a lot as a young man because he'd been born out of wedlock himself, but also because he married into a family that was much more socially established and sort of needed to be the husband that his wife's family expected of him. But in order to do that, he had to put aside some things that he personally wanted, like becoming mm-hmm. an artist. And so when he meets Sarah, and also when he meets Sarah's friends, and there are all these people who are, yes, living on the fringes of society and are very disrespectable and who get written about in the newspaper and who, you know, sometimes people make effigies of them in parades and it's very uncomfortable, but they also are really brilliant and have like these incredible, interesting lives and have a great deal of tenderness and affection and care for each other. And I think in the background of the book, Adam is sort of looking at this alternative life and going like, oh, well, what if I could have that? And Sarah is kind of his way toward a maybe a braver expression of his interiority than he was able to have before he met her.
Yeah, I totally feel that because – so I've read the book twice now because I got an – I know, right? I'm just a big fan here. No. But so the first time I read it was actually in February. I got approved for an ARC and I was like, oh my God. And so I like read it right away. And then I wanted to reread it again before talking to you just because it – I've read quite a few books in between. So I wanted to feel fresh. And I really – so the mm-hmm. first time I read it and you get to the ending, you know, and they don't get married, right? Like, oh my God, this is a historical romance. They always get married.
No, that's what? Yeah.
but then I had this moment where I was like, this is totally right for Sarah. I can't argue against it. Like, but how does Adam feel? But then absolutely reading it the second time, you know, knowing where it was going, I think as a reader, mm-hmm. I saw that in Adam's development. Like every single time that something comes along and he thinks about it and he reads her writings and he sees her friends and he sees these things and you absolutely see that growth in him. And so like when we were writing these questions out, I still, you know, wanted to ask you that, but I felt like that, you know, I felt like it was totally his character, that was his growth trajectory. And like you said, like he had a little bit of wiggle room there. So very, very yeah. cool. And I mean, I imagine that'll also be another kind of polarizing thing for readers in the beginning, right? Because like, you know, but hopefully they'll understand because I think it makes so much sense.
I think it does too. When I got to the ending, I very much put it down and was like, that was the only way it could have ended. Like, that was it.
Good. I'm glad. I hope people aren't upset about it, but like that girl is not getting married. Like Serafina Arden is not getting married. And if I had tried to slap on a wedding at the end, can you imagine?
Yeah, well, and she was so like, she was so like informed on the institution of marriage and she's like, this is what the institution of marriage is and I don't support that, so I'm not getting married. Like, and it was right. very clear and upfront, like at the beginning. So to have yeah. her get married at the end wouldn't have made sense. So I think, which is like for me reading the book, I realized that going through it and I was like, I wonder mm-hmm. how this is going to have its happily ever after, because obviously marriage isn't in the cards.
Right, right.
It was great. I mean, I also feel – so Sarah has – obviously she's such a, you know, a radical, shall we say. But – so she's also really aware of her body. You know, which I feel like in the beginning, you know, when she's talking about, you know, getting her period and feeling it in the tingles of her thighs and having her journal and like making ticks in that, like, I feel like she's more aware of her body than probably many of us are today. Like, I don't think that we're necessarily doing right by our young women. I feel like a lot of the time you know, tracking your cycle and understanding kind of like things about your body doesn't come in until you want to know about your fertility. And then all of a sudden you like learn all these things about your body that you just, why didn't anybody tell me this before?
Oh my Lord, so, Zoe. I recently had this whole thing because like I'm getting to the point in my life where I'm thinking about having kids. And I suddenly was like, I've always wanted mm-hmm. children. And suddenly I was being very afraid of having children. Like just the idea of how much change was going to go on in my body, it actually was starting to scare me a little bit. And then I just asked my friend who'd recently had a baby because like we're so close, like because I just didn't know enough. And it wasn't like I wanted to do research. I wanted to talk to someone about it. And then she was like, oh, yeah, because we just have that level of friendship. We could be really brutally honest with each other. And that was fine. And then I came away from it. I was like, oh, I feel so much better now. But like you get this fear. You get this fear. And it's like seems like taboo, like you're not supposed to talk about it. Versus anytime I felt I'm abnormal and then I talk to my friends and I'm finally just like, I don't even know what to do about this right now. My body is just like exploding. And they're like, oh, God, I know exactly how that feels. Like, and it's just so crazy because there is still so much secrecy. And I loved reading about Sarah and like her awareness of her body and stuff. And I was like, I should really be aware of these things too.
Well, I mean, I think like keeping a journal, which, you know, now there are apps for that, right?
There literally is on my watch. I noticed there's a menstruation app with your iWatch on your Apple Watch. It comes
with Apple.
Which I was like, huh, I'm probably not going to use it, but that's good to know.
Guys, I use Clue. Ooh. It's amazing. Great.
Okay. Excellent. Good to know. So I was wondering, is that through your research, did you find that women were in back in those times, like keeping journals of these sorts of things? Or was that just kind of a you know, an artistic license, shall we say? Or
I found that people were a lot more frank about pregnancy, miscarriage. The like presence of maternal mortality in society was a thing that is ever present. You know, it just the fact that women were having babies and that their bodies were sort of vulnerable in this way, vulnerable in two ways. One, because they could get pregnant and not really have control over planning their families in the same way that we are very lucky to have now. Then also just, you know, there was no guarantee you were going to, I mean, there still isn't a guarantee, but the frequency of maternal mortality in birth was so, so, so high. And so people would, you know, like it was commonly discussed, like, she's had four children, you know, we're not sure if it's good for her to have a fifth, but she's pregnant. Like, what do you do? Or her mother died in childbirth. So we're worried that she might be a little bit more frail or whatever. You know, people were just, they were constantly trying to figure out what was happening. And you see that kind of in diaries and letters, just in a way that I think sometimes like these similar themes will come up in my conversations about fertility and having kids with my girlfriends. Like, you know, like, what age did your mom hit menopause? Mm. Or like, whatever, like that we have a parallel today, but the stakes are less high. It's not like, did your mom die in childbirth because her hips are too narrow and cesarean sections don't exist yet? You know, like the stakes, thank God, are not as high. So I think the presence of sort of the maternal function of a woman's body has always been a topic of conversation in domestic life. I think the way that it shifts just sort of depends on the era in which you live. But in terms of artistic license, like because of the past trauma that Sarah has, because she, you know, had a child at a young age that died, and because that pregnancy was so scarring for her and it changed her future and her possibilities and her family and, you know, an incredibly traumatic event, she's like obsessed with not getting pregnant again. So I think that that is a very human response. Like I, you know, if I'm really worried about something, I find myself writing in my journal about it all the time, or like keeping track of little things like this and that, just because like I'm worried about it and trying to understand it better so that I can feel like I have some measure of control over it. So I think Sarah keeping track of her menstrual cycle is partly because she's a women's rights reformer who's like having conversations with the scientists of the day about how reproduction works and how to protect women and how to, you know, help improve their lot in life. And that includes becoming pregnant when you want to and avoiding it when you want to. But it's partly just because she's like terrified of the vulnerability that she has, both in terms of being injured by a potential pregnancy, but also of like her life changing in a way that she can't control because she wants to have sex, but she doesn't think she wants to have a baby. So that's very scary for her, understandably. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think I recently came across the fact, you're not the fact, the current figure of like how many people miscarry, you know, per pregnancy. And I think it's something like 25%. So that's like, even wow. Today. And I mean, a lot of yeah. miscarriages are very early, even to the fact where like, you know, you don't know that you're pregnant when you miscarry. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of a crazy thing, just because like I know many people who have in my life, and at you know, short and at long terms. And it's, I mean, it is a thing that happens a lot, and we don't talk about it, you know, very often. Yeah. I mean, we do talk about it. I think we see it more in historical romance because maybe it seems to us that, you know, it was such a prevalent thing of the time or whatnot. But But yeah, I also just, I loved that she took, that she wrote those notes in her journal, because I feel like so many of us spend so much of our lives trying not to get pregnant, right? Like we all, and then I just will say, like, when you get to that point of your life where you maybe do want to get pregnant, it's really weird because you realize that there's all these things you don't know. And then I just, you know, to stand up on my soapbox for a second, like long before you get pregnant, I just encourage everybody to learn about their cycles, like write in your little notebooks, like Serafina, learn about your bodies. Yeah. Like it's so,
get the Clue app.
Yes. Like it's very important. So anyhow, there I'm stepping down off my little soapbox there. But I mean, so you kind of touched on this earlier, but to me, it felt like this book, The Raycast, was just like such a complete thought. Like it felt like a fully realized creation. And like if you had told me that there wasn't going to be a series, that this was just a standalone, I mean, save for the like very last line, right? Where it's like, and then I would have totally felt like satisfied, and I wouldn't have been surprised, because it just feels like this is something that, you know, needed to be said, and here it is to read and see and process. So I guess you kind of touched on it earlier, but I was curious, like, did the idea for this specific book come to you first, or like did all three of these ladies and their combined story, was that kind of how it came to be, or what was that process like?
The book itself came first, and it came at a time when I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with it, because I knew that I wanted to keep writing my Charlotte Street series, and I wasn't like pausing that in any way, but I wasn't sure like if I wanted to start a new series yet, or like if I should do it traditionally or indie. And then my agent wanted me to try to do a traditional book, and I was like, okay, well, the only one that I really want to pursue that isn't Charlotte Street is this manuscript that I have. And I mean, it was like sort of semi-complete, but like in a very first draft form. And I was like, okay, well, let's see if we can sell that one. And then most of the time when you sell a book, you do it in the romance industry anyway. They tend to like to buy series as opposed to a mm-hmm. single title. Mm-hmm. So it was like, okay, well, how do I take this concept and like expand on it? Like, where would this world kind of go? And I just felt like since it was such a feminist story, like having it center around a group of female friends who all support each other with a similar mission would be like just the most, I don't know, kind of elegant way to kind of move it forward. So then I came up with the Lady Eleanor plotline, which did not exist in earlier forms of the manuscript. Before, it was just that Serafina was trying to raise money herself to write, to build this institute for women's rights. And then I was like, wait, what if she wants to do this because something dreadful happened and she's very angry, and then her friends have all come together and they're all doing something to raise money in order to meet this shared goal. And that's kind of where the Society of Sirens like idea took root. Mm-hmm. But she was always going to have like a strong group of female friends. So it's probably where it would have gone no matter what. It's just, I don't know, sometimes an idea comes to you in phases, I guess.
That's really cool. I'm like we've said, we're excited to read the next ones. I'm sorry we've subjected you to a whole hour of us gushing about your work.
But anytime. You want to talk tomorrow?
Yeah. Yes. So to finish off, we wanted to ask, what do you hope people take away from reading The Raycast?
I think in my heart of hearts, I want people to sort of look at it as a book that's about romance novels. You know, like it's a book that is about one particular woman and her friends and her lover and her story, and it obviously has parallels to things that are happening today and modern feminism and kind of the struggles and joys of fighting on the front lines for social justice. But I don't know, in a way, it's also just about what we allow our heroines to be and what we allow our heroes to be and what we allow a happy ending to be. And how can we become like more, I don't know, inclusive, in all the ways. You know, like, mm-hmm. I think we're making a big push in romance right now to improve the diversity in so many ways of the kinds of characters that we represent. And I want to include the kinds of stories that we're allowed to tell, including in more, I don't know, I feel like historical romance can have a very strong sense of it has rules and you have to follow them. And if you don't mm-hmm. follow them, then the book is, it's not succeeding in some way. And I really like to challenge that and to sort of think about how we can write different kinds of stories and examine, you know, intimacy and love in ways that are compelling and satisfying and meet the AGA and all the tropes we love, but do it in a way that's like, I don't know, a little looser.
There you go. Little looser, a little bit fresh. Ooh, I dig it. I really do. So finally, a couple little wrap up things, which is what is next for you?
Oh, great question. my current project is staring off into middle distance in my house, thinking about coronavirus.
I think that's everyone's thing right now.
I know. Don't tell my publisher. So the next, I have two projects that will be coming up. One is the next book in the Society of Sirens series. I think it will be called The Jezebel, but I haven't turned in the manuscript yet. So who knows where we'll end up getting with that. But it's Cornelia's book, and it's going to be a house party trope with a restorative justice theme. So Who knows? and then the other thing is I'm going to write the next installment of my Secrets of Charlotte Street series, which is going to be, there's this character, Elena Brearley, who's been in the background of all three of the first books, and she's going to be the heroine of the fourth one. And I'm really, really excited to write that one. Like, really excited.
I'm really excited to read it. I was wondering, because I also recently read The Lord I Left, and I was is there going to be one more?
Yeah.
Like, is she going to have a book?
Oh, so she is.
Exciting. Awesome. Oh, gosh. That's fantastic. And so I guess the last thing to ask is, where can people find you and your books?
Well, you can find my books wherever books are sold.
Yay.
you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram, both at Scarlett Peckham. I have like a Facebook page, but I don't really go to it, and I don't really recommend you do either. I have a newsletter that's kind of fun where I like, I don't know, like tell you stuff about what's going on.
It's really funny, and it's got a great name. She calls it the Scarlet Letter, so y'all should sign up.
Thank you, Zoe. I don't know. That's where I am. I love engaging with people IRL and on the socials, so come find me.
Fabulous. We are so excited that you joined us and we got to talk to you about this book. And again, I'm sorry we just, you know, kept lavishing you with praise, but I just really enjoyed this book. I really enjoyed it. I love what you brought and what you gave us and what I got to read. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us. We had a lovely time.
And so did I. Thank you both.
Zoe, she's so nice. And she listened to the podcast we did on her last book, and she didn't even comment on my, like, terrible thoughts on it.
Aw, your thoughts weren't terrible. I think they're valid. I mean, if anybody would appreciate controversy, I think it would be Constance, and I think it would be Scarlett, don't you think?
Yes.
I don't know.
Agree. She did like my recitation of her poem, though, so. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad. Yeah, that was very cool to hear. I mean, thank you so much again, Scarlett, for joining us. That was just such a joy to get to talk about something that we both obviously enjoyed so much and to get to hear your thoughts on how it came together. I mean, like, I was so curious about so many of those things. And, you know, I felt like as a writer, she was leading me as a reader, like, into thoughts and making me think about things. And it was very cool to kind of, you know that that yes, that's those were the lines that she was thinking. In many cases, some cases not so much. But I just, yeah, that was fabulous.
Yes, it was absolutely. And I loved all her thoughts on just like the age of getting into Regency, like, right. And it's something we didn't even get to talk about. But, you know, we talked about, she's like, how did we get from the Enlightenment to the Regency? And then all this like shame. And I'm like, yeah, how did we get from like the Enlightenment and then people like learning about science and their bodies and then to the Victorian era where you can't even look at a damn ankle? Like, talk about why we don't talk about women's issues anymore is because we were suppressed for decades and we're only just now getting our voice again.
Well, yes, but there's still people out there trying to repress us very hard. I mean, like,
I get that.
The parallels are so there and it's so interesting. And I think, like, as someone who loves historical romance, it is so fabulous to see a book that has so many parallels to today. Like that's a lot of what we want to take away from romance, right? Is the empowering aspect. And there was so much to feel empowered from this
book. I love her comment about how she's like, we're living in Regency London. We're just calling it 2020. And I was like, yeah, we are. Like, yes, it's a new time. It's a modern era. And yet we're still fighting the same battles.
Yep. But luckily, there are the Serafina Ardens in the world who will take up the banner and lead the charge, even in today's world. And even if I'm not that person, I love to shout about their cause. So I just had such a fabulous time reading and rereading this book. So thank you again to Scarlett Peckham. You can find her again on Instagram at Scarlett Peckham, on Twitter at Scarlett Peckham, and her website, which I believe is scarlettpeckham.com. Let me just double check that one. Yeah, it is. It's scarlettpeckham.com. So you should, like I said, I wasn't joking about her newsletter. It is fabulous. You should sign up. It always makes me smile.
Yes. And speaking of newsletters, there's still time to sign up for our email list this week to be automatically entered into a giveaway of a signed copy of The Rakes and some other awesome goodies from Scarlett. So even if you've already got a copy, you're going to want these because, you know, she signed it. It's special.
It is special. And so head on over to bit.ly/strumpet sign up to subscribe. And we're going to be announcing the winner this coming Monday. So woo, giveaway.
Yes.
So that leads us to our last little bit, which is what are we reading next week?
Next week, we're heading back to Bridgerton land.
Yay!
We will be reading When He Was Wicked by Julia Quinn.
Yes, I'm excited for this one.
Yes, we get to read about the elusive Francesca, who we've been mentioned about, but we really haven't seen since like book one.
No, she's very elusive.
Yes.
So I'm excited. I don't think I've ever read this book more than once, and I don't remember that much about it. I think I remember liking it, but feeling like it was very different than the rest of the Bridgertons just because it was so – it's off in Scotland. I mean, it's like removed, literally. So, but it's still written by Julia Quinn, so I mean – it's going to feel familiar.
Yes. I'm very excited to read it and get back to the Bridgerton family.
Yes.
And guys, this is number 6 of 8.
We're getting there.
We're getting there,
it's scary.
Y'all.
Well, but okay. But don't have no fear because then we have all the second epilogues.
Perfect.
Plus, once Bridgerton on Netflix comes out, you know we're going to be reviewing that. You know it. So there's plenty of Bridgerton content left for us. And I'm excited about that. But one last thank you again to Scarlett Peckham for joining us today, and we highly recommend you check her out on social and pick up her books. If you haven't read The Rakes and you're still listening to this, what the heck? We told you to read it first.
Yeah, go read it. It's so good.
Yes, go read it. It's very good. And yes, join us next week when we read When He Was Wicked by Julia Quinn.
And may all your ever afters end happily.
T
Tea and Strumpets is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts. Did we lose you again?
Okay. I can't hear what anyone's saying.
I thought we lost you.
So,
are you just?
I know.
We lost her. But like, why is this? Okay. This isn't going to work if it keeps doing this. We could always start a brand new call, but my goodness.
Oh, no.
I feel like it's her internet here, though. It's funny. I'm going to have 15 different recordings.
Oh, I know. You're going to have them. I mean, you could make like something really cool and postmodern out of this.
Seriously. Patchwork. Like, yeah.
John Ashbery poem of a romance interview.
Oh, yeah. That's what people are looking for with their romance interviews usually.
Oh, big time. Your subscribers and advertisers will go through the roof. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. The ad. Oh, okay. Fingers crossed that she's coming back. I guess I got to look at.
I don't know. And then I read Charlotte Gordon's book. Oh gosh, I just blanked on the name. It's a biography of Mary Wollstonecraft and her daughter, Mary Shelley. I'm going to just Google it real quick.
Go for it.
And then I'll say it again and you can edit it. Okay.
No problem.
Sorry, I should have written it down.
No, you shouldn't have. This is what Google's for.
Ah, okay. So I was reading Charlotte Gordon's book, Romantic Outlaws, which is...
Hey, everybody. It's Kelly, host of Boobies and Newbies, part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Every episode, I invite a romance reading newbie to read and review their very first romance novel alongside me, a self-proclaimed romance novel addict. We're talking everything from bisexual pegging.
We need more pegging on TV. We need it in books. We need it in real life. We need to talk about it.
To the deepest intricacies of relationships. It really is like we're fighting for us.
Yes.
Like we're, let's fight.
That's beautiful.
We cover it all. Find and follow us on social media at Boobies Podcast and catch up on previous episodes on your favorite podcast streaming platform.